my guest, Leon Von Braun, nephew of the legendary jazz trumpeter Clifford Braun. Thanks for joining me, Leon.
Thanks for having me.
Clifford Braun, the great jazz trumpeter, pianist, and composer, died in a car crash at the early age of 25, along with two other passengers in 1956. You've written that your mother was one of the last people to see Clifford Braun alive. Can you share any of those recollections with us?
Yes. Growing up in Wilmington, Delaware, our pastime was going to the Delaware racetrack, I think called Delaware Park racetrack. And so we would do that often. And so my mother and my father and my Uncle Clifford went to the racetrack this particular day. And my mother was talking about, she noticed that he wasn't his typical self, because he always would joke with her. He called her Butterball. And that was because she was pregnant with me at the time. So he was referring to her belly. And so they were good friends because they were close in age. So she noticed that he wasn't himself that day. And so she kept asking him, she said, what's going on? What's wrong? Are you okay? And he said, yeah, I'm okay. He said, but I have this gig I'm supposed to do. And I don't really want to go. I don't want to go. And she's like, oh, it'll be okay. Don't worry about it. He's like, yeah. And little did we know that the next day was the day when he went to Philadelphia, did that. He got the instrument shop there. And then right after that, they left to go to Chicago at 12 midnight driving. And that's when he got killed on that Pennsylvania Turnpike.
And you've also said that you grew up in your household hearing Braun's music and listening to your parents and other members reminiscing about time spent with your uncle. Can you share some of those and be as detailed and take as much time as you need in terms of recalling those moments?
Yeah, well, what comes to mind is how my father would tell me the story about how my father would come home when they were children or when they were young, and he'd find my uncle practicing. My father would tell him, oh, what are you doing wasting your time? Because, see, everybody, the backstory is everybody in the Braun family toyed around and played with instruments and with singing and with music, because my grandfather, Joseph Braun, he would bring broken instruments into his house there on 1013 Poplar Street in Wilmington. And he would fix these instruments. So when you went over to his house, it would be all kind of instruments laying around, a lot of stuff down in the basement. He even had a pool table in the basement. I don't know how in the world he got that down there, but that's another story. And so everybody sang, it was eight of them. And all these children, they would sing and play instruments and do that kind of thing. And so one day my father came home and he saw my uncle playing with the trumpet. And he told him, he said, what you doing wasting your time with that trumpet? And then so they challenged each other. Clifford said to my father, pick a tune, name a tune, and I'll play it. So my father, being the kind of person that he was going to pick the most difficult song he could think of. And so he said, yeah, well, play the Flight of the Bumblebee. And my uncle played that song. And after he finished, my father stopped and he just said, yeah, okay, go ahead. He realized that his brother had talent, because as you know, that song is very difficult. And so when when Uncle Clifford graduated from high school, he was, first of all, he was in the band there at Howard High School in Wilmington, which was the only Black high school that children could go to at the time. And he played, for his graduation, he played Carnival of Venice. And so he was very well known in the neighborhood. Also, imagine this, that he was playing all the time. So people on the Poplar Street kept hear would always hear this trumpet practicing over and over and over. And on the on one hand, the neighbors were tired of hearing that. My father was tired of, everybody was tired of, because you're hearing that over and over and over, hearing all this noise or this practicing and all these notes. But then on the flip side of that, my uncle would come out on the step and he would play songs for the students, the children that were in the neighborhood. So he would put on little concerts. My cousin told me about that. My cousin on my mother's side would tell me about how he would sit on the step and just play songs for people and children on the block. So it was a very, very musical family, and it was a very wonderful time. And there were a lot of supportive people around, because they allowed my uncle to play and do those kind of things so that he could become the person that he was.
He transferred to Maryland State College, which later became the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, which I worked and managed a jazz station there. And I'm just curious to know about the transition from moving from Delaware, from the university to Maryland State College. Do you have any recollections of why he made the switch?
Well, from what my parents told me, he made that switch because he started out in Delaware at Delaware State, but because of his, I think they told me that because of his music prowess, he transferred to Maryland so that he could really get more in-depth study of the trumpet. So that's what caused that change.
And I'll ask you, and this is your opinion, so you can give it to our audience as a just an avid listener, connoisseur of in the theater. But I'd like to get your thoughts, reflections on what jazz icons said about, Mr. Brown and felt about Mr. Brown regarding his mastery of his craft.
Everybody talks about how they were influenced by him. Freddie Hubbard, Roy Hargrove, Lee Morgan, and of course, Wynton Marsalis. They all revere him, because, and the reason is because they all talk about his speed, his fluidity, his accuracy of playing those notes. Because one musician even talked about saying that he played with such accuracy on the trumpet, the same way that that is more common for saxophone players. So, they also admired his technique and his versatility, because my uncle could play, he could play that hard, fast bebop, and then at the same time turn around and do torch songs, ballads with strings. In fact, to highlight that point, he did a album with Neil Huffty, who was the conductor, and it's called Clifford Brown with Strings, and it's a classic album, because he does all these jazz ballads, and he's backed up by a whole orchestra, and it shows his creativity and his versatility and his sensitivity to music, and that he's very versatile. So he could not only throw down with bebop, but he could also give you strings and classical music.
I want to talk a bit about you now. We'll circle back to Mr. Brown in the latter part of our interview. But you have a phenomenal credentials here. You danced in the HBO TV movie Miss Evers' Boys with Alfred Woodard and Lawrence Fishburne. Talk about that experience. That's fascinating to me. Tell me a bit and our audience a bit about that.
Well, that experience was very exciting for me as well. And it came in a very interesting way. I did my professional dance career in New York with Diane McIntyre, and she had a dance company called Sounds in Motion. Well, She also, in addition to having her own dance company, she was a choreographer. And like most artists, we get work wherever we can find it. So Diane ended up choreographing the stage play, Miss Evers Boys, that was done in New York. And so that was back in the 70s when when I first got to New York. She had done a lot of things there. So after I danced with her company, I came to Atlanta to live, and I moved back here back in the early 90s. Well, lo and behold, one day while I was after I got back here, now mind you, I hadn't danced in a while, several years, because I'd stopped dancing in New York, and then because and then I moved here to Atlanta. Diane calls me and she says, "Leon, this is Diane. I want you to come and dance for me. I'm choreographing the movie Miss Evers Boys." And I said, "What?" She said, "Yeah, I want you to." I said, "Diane, I haven't danced in so long. I can't do that." She said, "Yes, you can, Leon. Just come on. It won't. It'll be okay. You can do it." So I said, "Okay." So I go and start rehearsing with her, and she had me doing things that were dancing more than I thought that I could do. To the point where the producer came by and saw what we were doing, and he was extremely impressed. So when we got on set, it was very interesting because we had to do takes over and over and over because you never knew what take they were going to use in the actual film. So I was partnered with this guy from the Alvinelli Dance Company. And as we were dancing, each time they would say, "Cut, do it again," he said to me, he said, "Man," he said, "I'm going to do this full out every time because I don't ever know which take they're going to use for the film." And I was like, "Oh," I'm thinking to myself, "Oh, I mean, I got to do this with all my energy every time they say, do it again." I was like, "Oh." So we did it over and over and over. We did that choreography over and over so many times. But the end result was very good because it came out really well, and I was very pleased with what I saw. The only thing I was concerned about was when you see it in the actual TV HBO special, we were supposed to be dancing in this barn, and they had these lights, these lanterns hanging down. And so there's a part where I'm dancing and you can't see my face because of one of these lanterns hanging down. But it was done, and Diane blessed me with a director's copy of that dance. So in that director's copy, I could see the whole dance that we did because in the film they only use a clip. But Diane gave me a whole director's copy so I could see the whole thing from beginning to end. And that was really good. So that was a very good experience that I enjoyed so much.
And another experience, you recorded and toured with the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir, which shows on Radio City Music Hall and Carnegie Hall. Speak about that, please.
Oh yeah, that was wonderful. I went to the Brooklyn Tabernacle there in Brooklyn, and I joined the choir. And after joining the choir, I was very impressed with the choir director, Carol Cimbala. She had written a lot of songs, and she was a self-taught musician. And she wrote all kinds of she wrote a plethora of songs. And so many we there were so many albums that we did that we became very, very popular throughout the whole Christendom, and then other people started hearing about us as well. So it was we had a very prolific repertoire. And so every year we would do something at a venue that was very outstanding. And so one year we did Radio City Music Hall, and it was wonderful because we were down under the stage, and then they put us on a platform, some kind of a platform. And then when concert started, the music was playing, the introduction went, and then the next thing you know, you could hear our voices, but you couldn't see us. And we started rising up. They started lifting this stage that we were on, and we started coming up from the bottom of the stage. And it was this very, very dramatic. And I enjoyed that so much. And we were all dressed, the women were dressed in these beautiful gowns and the men were dressed in tuxedos. And that was a wonderful experience for me. And the same thing for Carnegie Hall. When we went to Carnegie Hall, it was unreal because there's it's a very plain venue, but when you sing, the acoustics in that place are fantastic. And so I was felt so good about being able to say that I sang at Carnegie Hall. So those are just wonderful experiences that I will cherish for the rest of my life.
And I can't help but say, performing at the 1996 Summer Olympics Games, that's breathtakingly amazing. Talk about that.
Oh, that was an experience that I wish that I had documented better, because I was taking pictures of it with this disposable camera. And that was a no-no, because when I got the pictures back, they weren't very good. But first of all, I had to audition for that. And I auditioned for Kenny Ortega. Kenny Ortega is the choreographer for Michael Jackson and all the other stars. And when I found out that I made the audition, that was the first thing that was exciting. It was such a wonderful and exciting experience just to know that I was going to be in the Olympics. Then we started rehearsing for it. And the thing about it was this was the 100th anniversary of the Olympics. And so what they were trying to do was they wanted to pay tribute to Athens, where it all started. So Kenny used this music, this ancient Grecian music. And his challenge, in addition to the choreography, was to hear and understand the different various tempos that this music had, because it went in and out of different meters. So I could see him with his crew working very hard to try to figure out how to get this timing together with this music. And then the next thing was, when we got the opportunity to start rehearsing in the actual stadium, it was phenomenal, because we're in a gigantic stadium, and we're working out all of this choreography in this big stadium, knowing that it was going to be for the Olympics. And then when we actually did it, it was such a moment. It was a two moments. One moment was that they had to had this technical thing where these columns came up in a circle, and then between each column was a screen, and we were going to be projected onto the screen. Our shadows were going to be projected on the screen, so it looked like a Grecian urn that had those images around it. And we were all holding our breath, because nobody knew if those columns were going to go up without any hitch on the actual day of the performance. Well, as it turns out, the columns went up without a hitch, and we were so glad, because in rehearsal, one of them didn't work. We were so glad that that happened. And then the moment for me was when the columns went up, you looked around, all these flashes went all of a big gigantic stadium, and all these flashes of people taking pictures of us. It was powerful. It was overwhelming. It was something I will always remember. And just to think that this was the last worldwide performance of the Olympics for that century, because then after that, it was into the 2000s. So it was just a very powerful thing. And then to see Muhammad Ali light that torch was another move. That was a very, very life-changing experience, I do have to say. It certainly was.
You choreographed a duet to his tune, Yesterday's which was performed at the 36th annual Clifford Brown Jazz Festival in your hometown of Wilmington, Delaware. Talk a bit about that production and event.
Well, it was a something that I came up with. I presented it to the Clifford Brown Jazz Festival Association, and what I did was we had a master dance class. I conducted a master dance class, and from that it was a way to get the community involved. And then from that dance class, I chose two dancers to be used for the duet. As it turns out, the two dancers that I chose knew each other and they had worked together as in the same dance company. So that was very interesting. And so it made it a good way to rehearse because they knew each other and they had a relationship already. So that was very nice. Then I started rehearsing for it and I was able to work with them and they immediately just gravitated to the work and they did a very, very good job of it. The duet was called Yesterdays. And this premise of the dance was that there was a woman who was going through some old clothes that maybe she was getting ready to throw away or something. And then she comes across a dance costume that she used to wear when she was a dancer years ago. And she's apparently up in her attic and she's looking at this costume, and she takes the costume, holds it in front of her, and then she walks over to a mirror and looks at herself with this costume held in front of her, you know, thinking about when she used to dance. And then her image in the mirror appears, and they're looking, and she's looking at herself in the mirror. And then eventually, what happens is that the image comes out of the mirror, and the two of them dance together. And then after they dance together, then the mirror image goes back into the mirror and runs away, and then the woman reaches for her and then looks down and she sees her old costume and she picks it back up and she's wondering, was that real? Was that a dream? What just happened? So it has a very interesting quality to it, and it's about yesterdays because she's thinking about a time in the past. So I enjoyed making that. And originally I wanted my mother to do that, play that part of the woman, but that never happened. But that was, so that piece was dedicated to my mother, who was my first dance teacher, by the way, because she taught at Abson Jones School, and I was, she brought me with her because she needed childcare. So I was only 5 years old. She taught me dance as a part of the dance program that they had at the school that she started, an after school program.
As we, move toward the end of our conversation here. My last questions, I'll just phrase it as passing the torch to the next generation. Clifford Brown passed away at the very early age of 25. I'm wondering how you would describe the impact of his passing the jazz touch at such an early age to those who came after him and you. How are you preparing to pass the torch to the next generation of singers, dancers, actors, and choreographers?
Well, that's a very deep question. And what I do is I'm doing these kind of interviews because that's where it starts. You have to talk about it. You have to make people aware of who he was, what his legacy was, and I have been charged with this duty to keep him and his memory and his legacy alive. Because there's an African spiritual thought that whenever you call someone's name, they stay alive. So I call his name as I do these interviews, Clifford Benjamin Brown. I call his name. That's how he will remain alive in our hearts and in our minds. Then the other thing is for me to get funding from whoever's listening and other organizations so that I can continue with this Clifford Brown dance choreography that I have. I have one dance already choreographed, and I have two others that I have in the works, because I want it to be a trilogy. And then I can take these dances and perform them different places to his music. So that's how I would do what I'm doing. That's where my contribution is. The other one is along those same lines, is to reach out. What I'm doing is reaching out to jazz trumpet players and other jazz musicians to let them know that I'm available to talk to them and to other people about his legacy. Along those lines, I graduated from Clark College. It's now called Clark Atlanta University. And I made friends with James Patterson, who is the jazz professor over there at Clark. But what I've done with him is I've gone over there to Clark College, and I have met with his classes and let them know that I'm Clifford Brown's nephew, and then and talk to them. I've done that and encouraged them in their careers. And then I also did a collaboration with Dr. Patterson by presenting his, because he did a tribute to my uncle, and I did a solo dance to his piece, Joy Spring. And so I've done that, and I want to do more of that kind of thing. And it takes funding and it takes money. So I've collaborated with jazz professors, and I'm also doing my duet choreography, and I'm going to need to do more of that so that I can pass this on. I've got the book of my mother that's published. So that's another venue where people can learn about my Uncle Clifford. So it's all along those lines. I'm doing things along those lines.
And as you do, you are continuing to pass the torch. My guest, Leon Von Braun, the nephew of the legendary jazz trumpeter Clifford Brown. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate what you're doing, and I appreciate what this means to my family. Thank you so much.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.